Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you to the second property law breakfast briefing of the Green List, Green's List for the year 2011. Regrettably, I was unable to be present at the first brief breakfast briefing, but I'm happy to be here for the second. It's nice to see such a large turnout because property law is a subject that most lawyers seem to shy away from, preferring the more esoteric areas of the law like criminal law, personal injuries, divorce, and commercial law. But it is my opinion that property law is far more stimulating intellectually than the other disciplines. Property law, it's quite simple. Property law is very, very simple. If you approach it from the question of concepts, that's all. It's not principles, it's concepts. Say, you take the fee simple is a large cake. And out of that you carve out your interests, you carve out your restrictive covenants, you carve out your easements, your leasehold interests. If you approach it that way, it's very, very simple. But of course, I've been doing it for 40 years. Anyway, to return to today's breakfast briefing, we've got two. They've not been very long at the bar, in that sense, in terms of years, but they are both experienced property lawyers. They've both been solicitors. The first is Bill Rimmer, and Bill and I have done quite a number of cases together, and I might say, funnily enough, very successfully. He came to the bar in 2004 after 13 years working as a solicitor. He worked at Blake Dawson Waldron until 1996, one of the ANZ corporate lawyers from 1996 to 1999, and then went to Arthur Robinson's, where he was a senior associate. I will leave the rest of the briefing to Bill, and I'm sure he won't let us down. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Namal. Mitch and I are chuckling at the concept of ourselves as fresh-faced, starry-eyed youths, but unfortunately our grey hair gives us away. We haven't been that long at the bar, but property law is a passion that we both share with Namal, and for the reasons that Namal has given. If you practice in that area, I'm sure you'll understand why that is. My paper today is on the rights of parties on non-payment of the deposit. Really, there's two simple points to convey, though there's quite a lot of law that I delve into in the course of the paper. First of those is that generally, as a general proposition, the failure of a purchaser to pay a deposit under a contract of sale, whether the obligation to pay is on signing the contract or whether it is an obligation to pay in instalments, constitutes a repudiation. So it's a breach that is fundamental to the whole nature of the obligation to pay the deposit and to the contract, and it entitles the vendor to rescind, and even indeed to rescind without prior notice, despite General Condition 25. But that general proposition, of course, is subject to exceptions. I always tell my students, property law students, it's not good law unless there are exceptions. And of course, the exceptions, when they apply, arise because of particular construction that may be put by the court on contracts before it. So each contract has, to, of course, to be considered in itself, but generally speaking, an obligation to pay deposit money is a central part of the bargain and will entitle the vendor to rescind. The second general proposition that I touch on in the paper is that a purchaser will not be entitled to relief against forfeiture of the deposit if the contract has been terminated because the purchaser has failed to pay it. That means, of course, the vendor can sue for it, recover it, and then it can be forfeited. And the exceptions to that are now very limited. And that is, unless the vendor has somehow caused or contributed to the delay, somehow lulled the purchaser into thinking that extra time would be given, and then seeks to rely on the breach to terminate, or alternatively, the facts fall within one of the cases of fraud, accident, surprise or mistake. All of this law has its origin, for the purposes of Australian authority, in a case of Bryan and Dwyer, 1978 Commonwealth Law Reports, 378. In that case, the contract required that the deposit be paid to the vendor's agent upon signing the contract. Unknown to the vendor, the purchaser did not pay the deposit at the time the contract was entered into. The court considered that the nature of a deposit was as an earnest or security for the bargain, in the sense that the purchaser is obliged to tender the deposit to the vendor at the same time as submitting a signed form of contract to show that the purchaser is serious about the bargain if the vendor chooses to accept, enter into it. So under that analysis, the payment of the deposit under a contract that says it's to be paid upon signing is actually a part of the negotiation process. The failure to pay it, if it's known to the vendor, of course, would mean the vendor wasn't obliged to accept the offer. That's simply because vendors would never be obliged to accept an offer in those circumstances anyway. But if the vendor has accepted the offer, of course, an executory contract has come into existence, but it's one which is immediately terminable by the vendor without notice. The statement that's usually cited as the leading authority, the leading judgment for that purpose, is that of Justice Jacobs at page 401 of the relevant Commonwealth Law Report. A deposit fulfills a very important function which would be destroyed if payment of the deposit is not regarded as an essential term. It's an earnest to bind the bargain, as was said in Howey and Smith. That's a 19th century chancery case. It is an assurance to the vendor, a security to him pending completion. He can take his property off the market and not concern himself with other offers in case the sale should go off, with the comfort at least that the deposit is there for his security. Now, each of the judges considered that the nature of the deposit under a contract for the sale of land had the effect that failure to pay the deposit upon signing, if the contract required that, amounted to a repudiation of the contract, which could be accepted by the vendor without prior notice. And I've cited each of the particular passages from the various judgments there in the paper. I won't read them all out to you. But it's instructive to read them because on this point the judges were unanimous, even though one of the judges, in fact Justice Jacobs, dissented in the outcome of the case for different reasons. So it followed, this was one of the issues in the case, that there's no basis for implying into the obligation expressed in the contract to pay a deposit upon signing a stipulation that the purchaser could pay the deposit within a reasonable time of signing the contract. The very nature of the deposit as an earnest for the bargain militates against such a construction. Bryan and Dwyer has been applied in Queensland to a purchaser's obligation under an option agreement to pay a deposit forthwith on executing the contract of sale, which they were obliged to do on exercising the option. I would submit that it also must be beyond doubt that Bryan and Dwyer expresses the law as it applies to sales of land in Victoria. I say this because I think that some doubt has been expressed in other quarters as to whether this is in fact the law in Victoria. And I'm making a very strong case to you this morning that it is the law in Victoria. It's a High Court authority, and there are other High Court authorities which I'll refer to in a moment that also have sort of support that conclusion. It hasn't actually been applied. There's no decision in Victoria that says where the matter was before the court as a live issue that payment of the deposit or failure to pay the deposit is a repudiation. But the decision of Bryan and Dwyer was accepted as stating the law by Justice Hedigan in the case of Kasher and Georgiev, where a provision for the payment of a deposit, he said, was usually a fundamental term of the contract. However, His Honour did make the rather obvious point in connection with that, that whether this is so or not in any particular contract must yield to the particular circumstances of each case. And the circumstances of that case are one that I'll come back to as by way of an exception, but one that was very particular to the facts of that case. Justice Hargrave also relied upon the passages cited above from Bryan and Dwyer as authority for the proposition that in circumstances where the deposit has not been paid, a vendor is entitled, but not obliged, to terminate the contract of sale. And that is a statement of principle in the case of Everest Project Developments and Mendoza, famous to you, of course, for other reasons that Mitch may or may not be touching on in his paper. So that's the position if the contract says that the deposit's paid or to be paid on signing, which of course our contracts in Victoria frequently provide for. But the High Court has affirmed, and I submit broadened, the application of the principles in Bryan and Dwyer to encompass a purchaser's obligation to pay a deposit by instalments. This is in the 2003 case of Romanos and Pantagold Investments. In the Romanos case, the vendors, who were the Romanoses, had sold three parcels of land to the purchasers, who were Pantagold Investments and another company, for a total price of $1.875 million. An initial deposit of $18,750 was paid on signing the contract, so that was 1% of the price. But the contract provided, in a special condition, that a further 9% of the price was payable as the balance of the deposit on the purchasers obtaining development approval to subdivide the land. I'm using that language of development approval rather than planning permit because it was a New South Wales case. And that's what they call their planning permits up there, as you know. Time was of the essence of the deposit obligations, both for the initial and the final payments. Once again, that's the case in Victoria and contracts as well. The council issued the development approval on the 24th of November 2000. Purchasers, however, only received notice on the 1st of December. But even so, they had failed to pay the balance of the deposit by the 24th of December, and the vendors rescinded without prior notice on that day. The purchaser approached the case as one of relief against forfeiture of the deposit. And in fact, the process or the procedure adopted was the equivalent of our Section 49(2) of our Property Law Act, where there was an application for the return of the deposit. So the question was whether it was just and equitable that the vendor retain the deposit in these circumstances. And the purchasers contended that the vendor had received a windfall as a consequence of the purchasers obtaining the development approval, because that development approval was for the subdivision of the land into a large number of lots, and unsurprisingly, that had considerably enhanced the value of the land. And the purchaser held it would be unjust, inequitable, for the vendor to retain the deposit and also to receive that windfall benefit. I will return to that aspect of the case below. But for present purposes, the High Court approached it as one of the application of strict contractual right. The vendor had the contractual right to rescind. And the majority referred to Bryan and Dwyer as establishing that a deposit was an earnest for the bargain, and it was this nature of the deposit that founded the legal principle that a vendor whose purchaser had failed to pay deposit money on the due date, whenever that due date was entitled to rescind the contract even without notice. At paragraph 20, the majority reasons I've quoted in the paper. I won't read it out. You can see for yourself. The effect of that is that not only is it the case that the vendor can rescind if unknown to the vendor a deposit which was meant to be given essentially as part of the negotiating process, when that's not paid, the vendor can rescind out of hand. But even where the contract provides for the deposit to be paid after the contract has been entered into, even then it's still such a fundamental obligation going to the very root of the contract, because the money is still earnest money, that a vendor can accept that repudiation if it's not paid. But I think there is still a question in Victoria as to whether a default notice is nevertheless required under General Condition 27 of our contract, which used to be known, of course, or used to be in Condition 5 of Table A. And there is an important distinction to draw between the New South Wales contracts, which were under consideration in both Bryan and Dwyer and Romanos and Pentagold, and the Queensland contract in Hill and Sydney. They're different in diametrically opposite respects. In the New South Wales standard contract, time's usually not of the essence of time stipulations in the contract, but only becomes so if the vendor serve a notice to complete under the standard conditions. That notice, if not complied with, makes time of the essence. So the significance of the High Court's decisions and other New South Wales cases on point is that the requirement to pay a deposit is construed as an essential term of the contract without the requirement to first serve the notice of complete to make it so. So if you don't turn up for settlement, you haven't breached an essential term of a New South Wales contract by failing to pay the balance of the price. It only becomes an essential breach and a repudiation if you fail to pay it if you serve a notice. This is quite different in Victoria, because you're in breach of an essential term immediately you fail to turn up for settlement, but you just can't act on it and as a vendor until you serve a notice of default under our contract. So on one level, one might say, well, what the High Court has simply said is, this is an essential term. There's no requirement under their contract that once the breach is the breach of an essential term, that notice must be given. So therefore, they don't have any restriction on the right of a vendor to immediately accept the breach of an essential term. Conversely, in Queensland, the usual form of contract makes time of the essence of all time stipulations, as in our contract, but unlike our contract, doesn't require any notice to be served before the contract is rescinded. So there's no equivalent of either the notice to complete procedure, as in New South Wales, or our notice of default, which can be turned into a rescission notice, self-executing rescission notice. So therefore, once again, in Queensland contracts, there is no need to hold that the breach of the essential term constituted by the failure to pay the deposit also amounts to a repudiation before the vendor may be said to be entitled to terminate the contract out of hand. But in Victoria, because of the way our contract works, if the vendor is to be entitled to rescind without serving a general condition 27 notice, one must say that the breach is so fundamental that it is a repudiation. We must actually, in Victoria, go so far as to find that the breach is a repudiation of the contract, because then the authorities show that a vendor may accept the repudiation by terminating without prior notice. Now, for the reasons I've given in the paper, my conclusion on this is that although the High Court, in the cases of Bryan and Dwyer and Romanos and Pentecol, appear to use the language of essential term when they're talking about the failure to pay a deposit, the language that they use also refers to such things as such a fundamental part of the contract, a breach going to the root of the contract. And that language, although they don't use the word repudiation, is the language of repudiation. So I would submit that the cases are cases where the breach clearly, in the High Court's view, amounts to a repudiation, and therefore no notice under General Condition 25 is needed in order to accept the repudiation. As I noted earlier, it's important to remember the theoretical foundation of the High Court's decisions here arises as one of construction of the contracts before the court. So in the final analysis, it remains a question of construction of each particular contract as to whether it bears the consequences, whether the failure to pay the deposit bears the consequences that I've said that most contracts in Victoria would have. So usually, under standard Victorian contracts, where the deposit is payable on signing or in two or at most three instalments, the construction of the obligations will be that given by the High Court in the cases I've referred to. But there are some limitations and exceptions. And Chief Justice Barwick said in Bryan and Dwyer that a vendor cannot delay inordinately in exercising that right. If the vendor goes on and performs or allows the purchaser to perform some of the steps in the conveyancing process, the vendor cannot then turn around and say, all right, I accept the earlier repudiation. That's probably not so much an exception, but an application of the principles of election, where the vendor can be said to have elected to affirm the contract. But an interesting example of a different construction being applied is the case of Kasher and Georgiev. Justice Hedigan was prepared to accept in that case that it was open to a magistrate, on appropriate evidence, to construe a contract as not entitling the vendor to rescind immediately on the non-payment of the balance of a deposit. In that case, that was a case where the contract provided that the balance of the deposit was payable on the 22nd of November 1996, but there was a finance condition which the magistrate held was to be construed as making the whole of the purchaser's obligations, including the requirement to pay the balance of the deposit, subject to finance being obtained by the 25th of November 1996. The purchaser had not paid the balance of the deposit because, of course, finance had not been obtained. Finance, in fact, wasn't obtained by the 25th of November. But the vendor then sought to say, well, you can't rely on it because, of course, there's that condition in our finance clauses which says that the purchaser can only terminate a contract for failure to obtain finance by the approval date if the purchaser's not in default under any other condition. So the magistrate held, well, even though that condition itself did not apply to the failure to pay the deposit by the 22nd of November. But before we get excited about that as a case which is of general application to finance conditions, it's important to note that Kasher and Georgiev was an appeal from a decision of a magistrate, and it turns entirely on its own special facts. Justice Hedigan, indeed, in the case, was at pains to point out that the facts of the particular case before him appeared to be highly unusual, and very little of the evidence was before him on the appeal so as to enable him to make an independent assessment of those facts. He merely held, this is Justice Hedigan, merely held that such a construction as applied by the magistrate could be open to the magistrate in respect of the contract before the magistrate, and so Justice Hedigan was unable to uphold the appeal without that evidence being placed before him. Now, it's submitted that in most cases of contracts subject to the standard finance condition in Victoria, which isn't relevantly different to the condition in the contract before Justice Hedigan, that the submissions of senior counsel for the appellant will be accepted and the opposite construction will be applied. Senior counsel submitted that Bryan and Dwyer had the effect that failure to pay the deposit was construed as a default in performance of an essential term of the contract, so that such a default would fall within the terms of the standard finance condition that a purchaser loses the right to rescind even if finance is not approved by the approval date, if the purchaser is in default under any other condition in the contract. So as Justice Hedigan himself noted at paragraph 26 in his reasons, there can be little doubt that the terms of the contract themselves imposed an obligation to pay the deposit by the 22nd of November, that is 3 days after the parties made the agreement, and did not specifically accept the deposit condition from the operation of the conditions as to finance. That is, no provision was specifically made that failing to pay the deposit of 10% by the 22nd of November was not a breach for the purposes of the finance clause. Now, I think that I've noted, and I say this with great respect to the author, of course, that in 1001 conveyancing answers, this case is cited as proposition for as authority for the general proposition that failure to pay a deposit will not fall within the condition in the finance clause that the purchaser not be in default. In other words, you won't lose the right to terminate under the finance condition if you haven't paid an instalment of the deposit. In my respectful submission, I would say that's not supported by Kasher and Georgiev. It's to be seen as one of the specific exceptions that I referred to that turns on its own particular construction. Yes, 3 minutes. Okay. So the question then that's left for the vendor's solicitor is whether if a purchaser has failed to pay the deposit, one ought to rescind out of hand or rescind by notice. Of course, this will depend on instructions and turn on commercial considerations. In a rising market where there are many purchasers who were knocked back, who may have purchased the property, the vendor will want the right to rescind out of hand so he or she can just simply turn around and sell to the next purchaser in line. But for various reasons, the vendor may wish to put maximum pressure on the purchaser in hand to settle, and so may instruct that a notice be given. The important thing, the important outcome of these considerations that I'm outlining today is that the choice is the vendor's. There is a choice. Now, the final part of the paper deals with whether there's relief available to the purchaser against forfeiture for non-payment of the deposit. The thinking of the High Court on this has changed somewhat over the course of the last 20 to 30 years, and particularly in the early part of the last decade, just at the time of Romanos and Pentagol. That's one of the cases. The other one is Tanwar Enterprises and Cauchy. The High Court has laid down very strict guidelines for when a purchaser may be entitled to relief against forfeiture of its rights under a contract of sale. And that will, those principles are that the vendor must have contributed to the delay, which obviously makes it inequitable for the vendor then to have relied on the legal right to rescind because of the delay, or else the case must fall within one of accident, fraud, mistake or surprise. You'll recall there was a case earlier than that, which was the leading case of Legione and Hatley, where the purchaser was held to be entitled to relief against the interest under a contract because the purchaser had entered into possession, built a house, and it was considered that that made the case one that fell within the more general concept of unconscionability, that made it unconscionable for the vendor to rely on the rescission. So specific performance was granted despite the purchaser's default. That case has been reinterpreted in the decisions I've referred to, particularly in Tanwa Enterprises, as being one of the vendor contributing to the mistake, because in other words, one where the vendor essentially had lulled the purchaser into thinking that more time would be given. That's not exactly the reasoning that was given by the High Court in Legione and Hatley, so that's a bit of rewriting of history. But now we must see that the law is that you'll only get relief against forfeiture of the deposit if you're a purchaser, if you can show that the vendor has essentially acted in a way that amounts to some sort of equitable fraud. So, generally, one would say that if the purchaser loses a deposit or is obliged to pay the deposit and it's then forfeited because the purchaser failed to pay it on time, the purchaser will not be entitled to have it to relief against that result. I think that brings me to the end.